A very warm welcome to This Is Money and Share Radio podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and you can catch me every weekday from 9 until 1 on digital in London, online at shareradio.co.uk. And if you have a smartphone or a tablet, through the Share Radio mobile app. In the studio with me today for our weekly catch-up, editor Simon Lambert, joined by consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, we've had a wealth of economic data out recently that some suggest show we, the consumer, are in something of a financial sweet spot at the moment.
Rising wages, falling prices, that's a real boost for family incomes. Of course, we've got to stay vigilant, make sure we don't have damaging deflation.
Or how will the figures impact on interest rates? And what is the true state of our finances? Simon will wade through all the details. Also today, 6 months after the new pension freedoms came in, it seems we're still scratching our heads over some of the finer details. So This Is Money have produced a handy guide answering your FAQs. We reveal the top ones. And just as well as this week, we've something new in the world of pensions to get our heads around. A government top-up scheme now makes it possible for millions to boost our retirement incomes.
If you're 65, you've got to live for 17 years to sort of get into profit on this. But it gives you that extra income guaranteed until you die, and of course you might live to 100.
Now Lee has been investigating whether bad banking is creeping back in as criticism mounts for sales tactics used by Lloyds. Yes, the very same Lloyds that scrapped the old-fashioned targets at the start of the year after all those mis-selling scandals. Well, from mis-selling to mistakes, how one firm was left out of pocket to the tune of $3,000 after a simple sort code error. And HSBC say, well, they can do nothing about it. Sometimes think you could do with a personal assistant to sort out all your car matters, things like perhaps tax renewal, or when you need an MOT, will AA think they might have the solution? Will the regulator jump in and do something about rising line rental as Sky becomes the latest to hike prices, or do we take matters into our own hands?
You could try haggling with them and seeing where, even with the increased line rental, if you could cut costs elsewhere, you may still end up paying less. It's worth a try.
Also, Simon has a warning for those planning to take the plunge with buy-to-let. And talking of property and our homes, are you a ConMarie convert? Do you even know what it is? If you don't, it's apparently the latest craze sweeping the nation, encouraging us to change our lives through the power of cleaning. Yes, including telling us to purge sentimental tat and get rid of any joyless items. So on that theme, I want to know today, be honest, are you something of a hoarder? What is in your home that you refuse or you quite simply just haven't thrown out and you have no idea why it is still there? A very good morning, Simon Lambert. A very good morning, Lee Boyce.
Morning.
Simon, I'm going to start with you. Are you something of a hoarder?
Yeah, I am. I do like to throw stuff out and I do like to have a purge of clothes, for example, every so often, but there's stuff I always end up hanging on to. So, for example, I've still got the Guns N' Roses t-shirt that I had when I was 11 years old. That's a prized possession. That's never being thrown out.
That's not bad, though. That's now vintage.
No, exactly. That's something that's worth keeping. Mm-hmm. But there are random things I keep, and basically, because I'm now a man and a dad and I'm in my mid-30s, I find myself keeping random bits of wood. So I think, oh, that might be useful. I'm basically turning into my dad. But we've just had a new kitchen put in, and actually one of the most cathartic things was not the removing the old kitchen and everything, all the stuff to do with that, but it was clearing out all those cupboards. It's like, do I need a bag of flour with an expiry date in 2012? No.
No. I'm more disturbed by the piles of wood that you've got around your house and garden. Lee, can you beat that piles of wood?
I am absolutely terrible for keeping football programmes. I've just got boxes and boxes of football programmes.
That's not hoarding. That's collection.
Yeah, well, it's...
It's a fine difference, Lee.
Well, when it's Southend United programmes from their terrible, you know, years in Division 3... When, you know...
You two need to fire together.
What are you ever going to do with those programmes?
I do sometimes flick through them and sort of reminisce about some of the players. But, you know...
One day when Southend are top of the Premier League and all that.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, well, don't give me that face, George. It could happen. It could happen. But, yeah, they're all at home back at my mum's house and she's on at me to sort of throw them out. What are you doing with these useless programmes? But, you know, they could be vintage one day.
They could be. They could be. Sentimental, if nothing else. I still have my old GCSE files.
No, well, I think
I have. Oh, that was. Yeah, but Lee, for you, it wasn't so long ago. Bless you, Annie.
For me, I'm having a battle in my household getting rid of a Corby trouser press right now. This thing is from the 70s and that's where it needs to go back to. Mm-hmm. I don't want it in the house. Don't want it. Kate says she's still got all of her old school books and timetables. Emily says, I have a problem with throwing away old makeup and nail varnish. You never know when you might need yellow eyeshadow for fancy dress. Paul says, a very large back catalogue of cyclist magazines. Richard has old mobile phones. I've got four of them, including my very first Nokia brick.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Keep them coming in.
Please do. You can tweet us at Share Radio UK. You can email consumingissues@shareradio.co.uk or send us a text to 66777 and start your text with the word Share and standard network rate supply.
To celebrate Share Radio's first year, we're giving away a Pure Evoke D2 digital radio every single week. Many lucky winners have already received theirs, and you could be next. To enter, visit shareradio.co.uk, register your details, and you'll be entered into the weekly draw. Open to UK residents over the age of 16. Visit our website for full terms and conditions. Share Radio, sharing ideas about money.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio on Digital in London, online and through the Share Radio mobile app. I'm here every weekday from 9 until 1. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, back in the studio for our weekly catch-up with me to run through some of the stories they've been looking at over the last 7 days. I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert, consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. Lots to get through today. Pensions, property, and coming up, we'll be hearing again that staff at Britain's biggest bank, Lloyds, being told to sell more or lose their jobs. But first, we've had a wealth of economic data out that some have suggested we, the consumer, are in something of a financial sweet spot at the moment. Unemployment's fallen to its lowest level since before the financial crash. Wages are up, retail figures up as inflation dipped again, and of course, interest rates remain at record lows, starting with the Consumer Price Index then. And that is, of course, the measure of the cost of living. It was minus 0.1% in September. It's been hovering around zero since February. It's been put down to a fall in the price of things like clothing and petrol. It's also the 15th month in a row that food prices have fallen. Chancellor George Osborne welcomed the news, but with some caution.
What you see at the moment is rising wages and falling prices. That's a real boost for family incomes. Of course, we've got to stay vigilant and make sure we don't have damaging deflation. That's what we have the Bank of England for.
Also, as I mentioned, unemployment's fallen to its lowest level since before the financial crisis in 2008. Between June and August, it stood at 5.4%. So those in jobs jumped by 140,000, pushing the employment rate to 73.6%. Incidentally, that's the highest since records began in 1971, and the number of unemployed people down 79,000, the biggest fall since the 3 months to January. Speaking to Share Radio, Hannah Maundrell, editor-in-chief at money.co.uk, is also a little bit cautious about the figures.
The key thing here is there is still an issue with people not being able to find reliable work and not being able to earn a decent standard of income. Hopefully we'll see this improve next year when we get the national minimum living wage come in. We are seeing wages increase. We've seen the 3% increase. We've got low interest rates still. It will be next year. You know, the price hikes really start to kick in, and that's when having a decent job and earning a decent amount of money is going to be really important.
So, Simon, it was actually Hannah there that said a sweet spot at the moment. What do you make of the figures that we've been hearing throughout this week for the consumer?
Well, to listen to George Osborne, you'd think that mild deflation had been the plan all along, wouldn't you? All those years of low, record low interest rates and all that quantitative easing, mm-hmm. just to basically ensure that we had some mild deflation. That's actually the opposite of what central bankers want. They want some inflation. But at the moment, it is good for people. Their wages are going up and prices aren't going up. And there are some points where people are really benefiting at the moment. So you've got the supermarket price mm-hmm. war, which is pushing down food costs. Probably bad news in the long run for anybody who produces food, which is also bad news for those of us who eat food. But you've also got petrol prices are low. And then you've got energy bills, which a lot of people's energy bills are now quite a bit lower than they were maybe a year or two ago. So those things that you have to spend your money on regularly, they are cheaper.
So there are some good things to consider, but also are there some things in the economic data we should be concerned about? I'm thinking particularly, I mean, you mentioned there deflation, bad deflation, but also slow wage growth that we're seeing.
So wages are going up by nearly 3% at the moment. But you've got to remember that that's coming after a period where real wages have fallen. So wages after people have basically been paid less money once you take into account inflation. And we've seen really, really low wage growth out of the back of the financial crisis. At the same time as the cost of many things that we would like to buy have gone up quite a bit, particularly houses. The concern is that what might happen is companies might turn around, say that we're still at 0% in a year's time. There's no inflation in a year's time. Companies might turn around and say, well, you know what, actually, you're not going to get a pay rise of 3% this year. You're going to get a pay rise of 1%, and you should count yourself lucky because that's still above inflation. Mm. Or maybe you're going to get a pay freeze, but don't complain about it because there's no inflation. So that's the concern where deflation starts to kick in. Also, there's this thing where economists suggest that basically the reason why prolonged deflation is bad is because you might not buy something now because you think it's going to be cheaper sometime down the line. I'm not sure that I particularly buy into quite a lot of that, unless you've actually got a serious scenario where you've got deflation of maybe like 3%, 4%, 5% over a prolonged period of time. I think what we're seeing at the moment, nobody's going to stall buying something that they want to buy.
What all of this has done, though, Lee, is it's made us want to play our favourite game of guess when interest rates are going to go up again. Some are saying not until spring. Some saying actually January. If you look at a lot of your articles, well, it's completely mixed. I mean, interest rates should go up soon to prevent wage increases. According to this article here, Bank of England says interest rates should be cut or could be cut indeed. What do we reckon?
Well, it's almost like no one knows the answer, which
almost.
Is... well, look, I mean... I think the important thing to think about at the moment is that if you're feeling a little bit better off than you have done in previous years, you know, your wages have gone up and you're finding bills are dropping, is to make sure that you are well shielded from any kind of rate increases next year. So that could, you know, have a knock-on effect on your mortgage, for example. So if you're feeling at the moment, you know, that your wages are going up and it feels a bit better, it's good to be sort of trying to put a little bit away, bit of money away, just to negate any sort of bad things that might happen when rates do go up. But it's just so hard to predict. You know, there's a lot of pressure when these inflation rates are so low or deflation happens because, you know, economists start coming out and saying, well, rates should be going up sooner. Mm. So, I mean, it's not, I'd be very doubtful if anything's going to happen before the end of the year. But, I mean, you think by mid next year. But I'm sure we were in the studio this time last year probably saying the same thing. It's a good game.
the question is, basically... interest rate rises penciled in for, say, spring 2016. That's what economists and the money markets suggest in this country. But is something bad going to happen between now and spring 2016? And we don't seem to place a particularly high threshold on bad things happening to stall interest rates. So the Fed in the States were, you know, supposedly going to put up rates over summer. They didn't. Then it was supposedly going to be September. Then we had the big Chinese stock market falls, bit of a rout in the oil price. And all of a sudden, the interest rate rises on ice. But, like, really, is that a high enough threshold to not raise rates? I mean, there's also this suggestion that they might cause all kinds of problems in emerging markets and things like that. But actually, I think a lot of it is the uncertainty. And perhaps maybe there is an argument for saying, right, put a marker down. Yeah, we all know rates are going to rise very slowly, but put a marker down and raise them.
But I was curious to know as well, we've talked about what it means for the consumer, but what do these figures mean for the economy more generally, the state of the economy in the UK and the idea that raising interest rates, recovery is fragile, so should we be rocking the boat in this way, especially when you factor in other figures I've not mentioned, trade, manufacturing, particularly disappointing, and also, like you mentioned there, global uncertainties?
Well, so I guess the question is, and this is the question for the MPC that they have to answer once a month, is can the economy cope with higher interest rates? Would it derail the recovery? I think probably the recovery is strong enough and that the consumer recovery is strong enough that we probably could raise interest rates. Obviously, for most individuals or businesses, even a small rise in interest rates doesn't actually have that much of an impact. Adrian Lowry of This Is Money, one of our team, wrote something last week saying, you know, all this fuss about something that actually, for most people, would cost less than a holiday that was a bit more expensive than they thought it was going to be. And that is ultimately true. But it's the cumulative effect of all of that. I don't know. You've got to remember that, obviously, there are people out there who would like to have higher rates, savers, for example. And there is this argument that actually the low rates that we've seen over the past 6 years are counterproductive, and that what it's doing is people are not spending money because they're worried about the lack of return that they're getting on their money. Arguably, the people with the money in this country the older, wealthier generation, the people who do tend to have more savings, would they be encouraged to spend if they were getting a better return on their savings? Because actually, what we've found is this situation where the low returns on people's savings means people are just saving harder. Mm. So they're saving more money rather than spending it.
One final thing I want to talk about savings there. September's CPI figures, Lee, not just another number, used to determine annualised allowance and the state pension. So
indeed,
you're the winners and losers in this.
It's actually linked to quite a lot of things that happen next April, so the September figure. So, for example, the cash ISA, or the ISA allowance overall is £15,240. It went up 240 quid this April because of the CPI figure for last September. Now, they haven't come out and said exactly what's going to happen for the 2016 allowance, but it's likely it's going to be frozen at £15,240 because there's no rise. But stuff like the state pension, which has got this triple lock protection, so basically it will go up by at least 2.5% regardless of how CPI is done, unless CPI is obviously above that rate. So state pension's sort of unaffected. But it's sort of linked to other things that happen in April.
Indeed. That voice you're hearing, Consumer Affairs editor Lee Boyce, joined in the studio by editor Simon Lambert from This Is Money.
Hello, I'm Ed Mitchell, and I present Investment Perspectives Wednesday to Friday, 1 to 5pm. We take a deeper look at all the major issues that underpin your investment decisions. Investment Perspectives, guiding you through the money labyrinth.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
A very warm welcome. Coming up, more on the firm left £3,000 out of pocket after handing out a slightly incorrect sort code. HSBC says it cannot do anything about it to get the money back. But let's stick with a bank, a different bank, Lloyds Bank. Now, is a sales target culture the nasty one creeping back? This is something that, Lee, you've been looking at for some time. We've spoken about it before on the show, but now we're hearing again that staff of Britain's biggest bank are being told to sell more or lose their jobs. Now, bosses are reportedly demanding mortgages, insurance, credit cards are pushed aggressively under the, well, somewhat rather unfortunately named Project Labrador. Sounds cute and cuddly. Lloyds, which is 13% taxpayer-owned, got rid of the old-fashioned sales target, you might remember, in January after all those mis-selling scandals cost them billions. So, Lee, that didn't last long. Project Labrador?
I know. Well, what's happening is basically I get contacted a lot by sort of whistleblowers that work at banks and building societies over the years. So I'm talking about the last 5 or 6 years. Now, what's happened since, I just seem to get contacted now by Lloyds staff rather than anywhere else. Now, I don't know if that's a factor of what's going on and it's just Lloyds that are sort of doing this. But earlier in the year, they promised to sort of clear up any of these sales tactics. So if you went into a branch, you might have previously been pushed to take out a package current account or a loan that you didn't particularly need. Or if you did want a loan, well, why don't you take out £10,000 rather than £5,000? Because it was linked to staff pay. So it's all linked to bonuses. The more that they could get these products out, the more likely they were to hit collectively as a branch their targets and get bonuses and not face pressure of losing their jobs. Now, what's happened since they've done this, they've got this new sort of customer-focused target. Well, this is what they tell us anyway, that it's all about customer feedback. So if people are happy that they've come into the branch and they've been served correctly, everything's good, they get feedback and they get their bonuses linked to that. Mm-hmm. Now, what's happened, interestingly, we saw some figures earlier in the year. In the first 12 weeks of 2015, Lloyds saw 45% fewer people taking out loans.
That's a lot.
In branch, which, well, you might think, well, it might just be loans. Then you look at other stuff. You know, in the first 3 months of 2014... there was 50,000 insurance products taken out in branch. This time, at the same time this year, 15,000. So, less than half. So sales are suffering in branches. And I think, there's been some sort of management changes over the summer. And I think they're starting to creep in these sort of old-fashioned targets again. This Project Labrador, as you say, it's all, sounds very sort of fluffy and you think of a nice big Labrador. Mm. But, I mean, some of these staff are under, significant pressure to hit targets, to push products on people. I've read somewhere that the ideal staff members should be selling one product of each thing, so one current account, one loan, one per week or per month or whatever it is. If they don't meet it, they're put on a sort of performance plan, and then if they're not meeting it after that performance plan, it's out the door.
Now, I'm going to quote Tory MP Mark Garnier, a member of the Treasury Select Committee, said that at the end of the day, like any business, and you have to agree with this, Lloyds has to make money, but it has to balance this with the ethical reality of tidying up a legacy of bad practice. We need to keep a close eye on how this develops. Because, of course, the PPI alone mis-selling scandal cost the bank $13 billion already, Lee.
Yeah.
Scandal blamed on that ruthless sales culture at the banks. Yep. Have they learned nothing? And why would they risk this again?
Well, there we go. I mean, I don't know if this is going to be as bad as what things were, you know, in 5 years ago. And that sort of stuff is really rife. You think, I wouldn't presume that this is going to be as bad as those PPI days. But at the same time, you don't want to be going into a branch and feel like you're getting hassled and see an investment advisor, or, you know, do you want to take out this loan? Or, you know, you want that current account, why don't you get this one that's, you know, £10 a month or whatever, and you get all these additional perks to it. And this is where Lloyds has missed that, sort of fallen off, sales have fallen off a cliff this year, because, you know, you clearly see that there's a link between aggressive sales, you know, pressures in branch, and they're making money out of products that they're selling in branch. So it's, I think for them, it's trying to find the balance of what, you know, to keep staff happy, not bully them and pressure them, and also when people go into branch, not to get harassed for products.
Absolutely. What have Lloyds said, by the way, Lee?
They're pretty coy about it all. They've kind of denied this, or refused to confirm the existence of Project Labrador. And also, when I spoke to them last week, because I was told that they had some sort of pilot scheme going on in some branches up in Cumbria. And again, they sort of refused to sort of say that that was happening.
Mm.
And, you know, their targets have changed this year, and it's all about a customer experience and customer feedback. And they're, you know, refusing to sort of tell us if this is genuinely going on.
What do you make of this, Simon?
I think the problem is, for a bank like Lloyds especially, which is, like, very consumer-focused, you know, is that basically it's a lot of pressure to return to, you know, making really good profits. But the profits that the comparison is being drawn with are the profits pre, you know, financial crisis. And those profits were massively, you know, probably over-egged by things like the mis-selling of PPI. And the banking industry, the retail banking industry, was making a lot of money from selling people stuff that they didn't need and pushing products on people during that period of time. And the difficulty is, if you're a massive organisation and you're having those comparisons drawn, is what do? Do you stand up, put your head above the parapet and say, do you know what, we're actually never going to be that profitable again? I'm not sure that the chief executives of any banks are going to be willing to do that, because they get crucified by the shareholders. But, I mean, the thing about some of this stuff going on is my concern with the banks is over some of the packaged current account stuff, and there's been a lot of pressure on them from that. The FCA's basically, you know, said we've got this on our radar. And with
Tell
PPI,
us a bit more about that.
Well, it's basically paid for bank accounts, and it's people who probably don't need them and get sold a paid for bank account. And you think, oh, this isn't happening. You know, people are wise to this fact. They know they shouldn't be paying for their bank account. I was talking to a friend about this the other day. He's got a paid for bank account. I was like, why on earth have you got a paid for bank account? He's like, oh, they told me I had to have it. I was like, what do you mean they told you you had to have it? They said, oh, you've got to move to one of these accounts and it'll cost you £10 a month. I was like, well, do you want it? He's like, no, I don't want to pay for my bank account. And this is a classic example of this kind of thing.
Well, your stats bear it out, those 45% drop when sales tactics are watered down a little
bit. And with PPI, you know, in the financial media, we were reporting about that. For years, we were telling banks that they were mis-selling PPI and they didn't do anything about it. So then you question, well, we're saying you're mis-selling packaged accounts and they're not doing anything about it. Does that mean they're not mis-selling them, or are they just ignoring it?
They got in trouble. I mean, the FCA did look into packaged current accounts, and I think they did get fined. And also, we actually revealed, and I'm sure it was about the start of last year, so 2014, that they were banned from selling packaged current accounts in branches for an indefinite period because of that sort of thing that Simon's talking about.
Well, from mis-selling to mistakes, we'll stick with our one last banking story, from Lloyds to HSBC now. Have you ever paid money into the wrong account by accident? Perhaps a slip of your finger on the phone pad, you've mixed up just one number of a sort code, you've handed out incorrect current account details, resulted in a non-payment. Now, did you get your money back? If not, you are not alone. Lee, you've been looking into the case of a Welsh business owner left thousands out of pocket after giving out the wrong sort code to a customer. Now, the £3,300 was paid by the customer, but it ended up in the account of an HSB customer in Bristol instead. Now, HSBC say that now they can't debit the beneficiary's account without the customer's authority to do so, and they can't get hold of the person.
No. This is a really sort of strange story, but one that's so easy. It's such an easy mistake to make. I mean, this guy has given out a sort code that's just two digits wrong, right? Mm. I mean, as you say just, it's incorrect.
Well,
it's correct, but
twisted two it's, around,
it's twisted
it?
Two yeah. around. The account number is completely correct. Mm. And actually, very worryingly, and I never really knew this or thought about this before, but people have the same account number. So you could potentially have the same bank account number
wow.
as someone else, but your sort code might just be different. Now, I find that absolutely baffling. How is there not enough eight-digit codes to yeah. go around for customers? I really just don't understand it. It kind of gets more, I have to crunch the numbers and figures and see, but absolutely bonkers. But this money's gone into this current account, someone in Bristol, mm-hmm. you know, and...
And why can't they get the money back? HSBC, they must know who this person is. Can't they just call them up?
They should have a team, shouldn't they? HSBC should have a team of heavies that go around, check out his addresses and say, look, are you Mr. So-and-so?
I'm just thinking, pick up the phone or send an email.
They've tried that, though. So that's the thing. They've called, or they say they've called, they've emailed, they've sent letters. I don't know how many times they've, you know, tried to do this, and they've kind of washed their hands of it. And I find it's quite frustrating, because it's not like this guy that's handed out his bank account details given a completely, you know, bonkers account number. It's just a little discrepancy on the sort code. But HSBC just basically say they can't do anything about it, and it's a legal matter. Mm. But he's been quoted $2,500. To take this to court, basically.
That's
and
the Norwich Pharmacal Order.
Yeah, so it's some old sort of ruling where you know, courts can obtain information from banks and companies, but it comes at a high cost. So unless this is tens of thousands of pounds that have gone missing, you know, it's £3,300. You'd have to pay $2,500 to get three and a bit grand back. So it's a pointless thing. But what I find really interesting is actually end of last year, HSBC, one of the banks, actually said they were rewriting the terms and conditions so that it'd be able to haul money back when it goes missing this way, and that they would sort of give it 10 working days to get the money back. And if they didn't hear anything from letters, emails, phone calls, they would actually take the money back and ring fence it and investigate until it'd be done. So it's worth pointing out that this money went missing in October 2013. So it's come a year before, you know, HSBC, they can actually do something about it. But interestingly, I've had a good five or six emails of people who have done exactly the same thing.
Well, this one guy can't be alone.
He can't be alone. And, you know, I've had one that said, instead of giving 87 as a sort code, 89 instead, and £2,500 gone missing. Bank won't do anything about it. Had another one, I think it was about 30 or 40 grand, had gone accidentally to a Barclays account rather than a Lloyds account because they slightly got the sort code wrong, and they've been told they've got to take legal action if they want to get the money back. So it is rife.
Before we get the views of Simon, I just want to know, you do want to hear from other people, so how can they get in contact with you?
Yeah, you can just email me at lee.boyce@thisismoney.co.uk.
Simon?
I can tell you a funny story about this. Many years ago, just after we'd sort of finished university, one of my best friends had some money paid into his account by accident. It just landed in there one day, and I think it was about £5,000. And it came from a loan company. Mm. I can't remember what their name was. It was something like Lombard Financial or something, Lombard Direct or something. And he got this money, and he phoned me up. He's like, what should I do? And I said, well, you basically have to give it back. It's not yours.
Yeah, I thought it was illegal to keep it, right?
And he's like, well, maybe I should just hold on to it and, like, put it in another account and like, just in case they, you know, maybe they won't notice. So I said, well, whatever you do, just don't spend any of it because they will ask you for this money back. And he got a letter from the company saying, we've paid you this money by accident. It's a loan application. We've paid it to you. You need to give it back. So he's like said, okay, you know, but can you tell me who took this loan application out? Because I'm a bit worried about how it's ended up in my bank account. They said, no, sorry, data protection. We can't tell you any of that.
Yeah, exactly. It's all data protection, isn't
it? So but they sent him a threatening letter and said, basically, if you don't pay it back, we will take you to court. So he was obviously looked at it and said, yeah, I'm going to have to pay this money back. Because as a company, they had that opportunity open to them that this chap doesn't have because it's going to cost him £2,500. So he pays them the money back. A week later, the money ends up back in his bank account. They paid it back in again. And then, so he's like, what do I do? So they sent him, then he didn't hear anything from them. And then they sent him a letter saying that, you know, he needed to pay this money back about 4 weeks later. And he wrote them back the most amazing letter you've ever read, telling them about the stress they'd put him under, how he was a poor student, he didn't have any money, he'd spent some of it and he couldn't give it all back. And he was really, really sorry. And he could give them back what he had left, but he couldn't give them back the rest. and he was in loads of debt. And do you know what? They let him off the money he'd spent.
No.
Basically, it was the best letter I've ever seen. I think he'd spent a grand.
I think he deserved that. If you're going to make the same mistake twice, then I think he deserved to take at least
they
a grand out of that.
They don't deserve the money back. Indeed, I was thinking you could put it in a high interest account. You'd have to spend it, right? But you could still earn a little bit of interest on it, couldn't you?
Well, in those days, you could have put it in a high interest account. Now you'd be putting it in your 1.5% cash ISA.
You make about 80 pence over the 4 weeks.
Oh, coming up, we'll be talking all things pensions and property.
So you want to learn to make the most of your money? Of course you do. But you want to learn while also listening to satirical songs and sketches? Of course you do. And that's why we invented Managing My Money. Let me move your rates up
and down. Let's talk. Huge debt. So won't the real big savers
please stand up? Please stand up. Managing My Money is an official Open University course. You can take the test and earn yourself an Open University certificate to show how financially savvy you've become. So join Annie Weston and me, Glenn Goodman, every Monday at 9 p.m. And if you miss an episode, go to the Share Radio website to find out when it's repeated, or just download a podcast instead. It's never been easier to fill that hole in your no-zone layer.
And for more information, do go online, shareradio.co.uk. I'm Georgie Frost. This is Share Radio, and the team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, are with me, editor Simon Lambert, consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. So far, we've looked at a host of economic data, which has left us, well, no clearer about when interest rates will rise, asked whether aggressive sales culture is back at Lloyds, and how slip-ups with sort codes and the like can cost you dear. Now, it is 6 months since the new pension freedoms came in, but it seems we're still getting our heads around some of the finer details. Luckily, the team from This Is Money have answered their readers' 10 most common queries, and it's just as well as we now have more pension changes to get our heads around. A new government top-up scheme came into force this week, making it possible for millions to boost their retirement income. So let's focus there first, shall we, on the catchily titled Class 3A contributions. That will provide an income to rise with inflation, but it's only available to certain people, and Share Radio's personal finance expert Ed Boucher says it won't be the best option for everyone.
If people are wondering, well, will I make money from this? Well, if you're 65, you've got to live for 17 years to sort of get into profit on this. So it doesn't make sense to go for this if you think your health isn't that great, but it does make sense. It gives you that extra income guaranteed until you die, and of course you might live to 100.
So tell us briefly how this will work. Simon, come to you first.
Well, what's being offered to people is for those people who won't get the full qualifying period for the flat rate state pension, they can basically buy extra years. And what that does is it bumps up the amount that they'll get for their pension. So if you're 65, you pay £890 for each £1 extra a week in pension that you want. So if you wanted the full £25 a week that you can buy extra, it would cost you £22,250. That sounds like a lot of money for not a lot of money back, doesn't it? £25. But actually, if you work out the return on that, it's a 5.84% return. And that's if you're 65. If you're 70, then it costs you less money because you're more likely to die soon, to put it bluntly.
Yeah.
And so you'd get the equivalent of a 6.67% return. Now, if you look at buying an annuity, which is a product that will provide you with an income for the rest of your life, you're not going to get rates like that that bring the same benefits as the extra state pension does. If you looked at putting that money into a savings account, for example, as a comparison, you're definitely not going to get rates like that. So for those people who've got reasonable longevity, then this actually looks like a very, very good deal. The difficulty is, of course, is working out how much longer you're going to live, which nobody really knows. But if you're in good health, you're not one of those people who is probably at risk of dying earlier, then it could be a very good investment.
Can anyone do this? How many people are going to be affected, do you reckon?
Well, it's open to men born before April 6th, 1951, and women born before April the 6th, 1953, who live in the UK and already receive a state pension or are entitled to one. And 265,000 people are expected to take up the offer, which closes on April the 5th in 2017.
Very good. This is different, though, is it not, to national insurance contribution top-ups related to pensions?
Yeah, people should. What people shouldn't get confused with here is this big fuss surrounding the flat rate state pension at the moment, which is to do with people getting their pension projections and discovering that they are much, much lower than they thought they were going to be. And that's because the flat rate state pension moves to a point where there is just one pension amount, which is going to be about £150 a week, versus the old system where you used to have the basic state pension plus the state second pension, which is an extra thing that people paid into. But many people were contracted out of that. And there's this comparison that the government will do to decide how much pension you're going to get. And there's a lot of people out there who, because they were contracted out, are going to get much less pension than they thought that they were going to get. And if you're in that position, you can't buy that extra back. That's not that. You know, this is for people who don't have the full 35 years of national insurance contributions and they want to buy extra years.
Well, if you've got your heads around that, good. Good for you. Because we're going to be talking now a little bit more about pensions, but the pension freedoms. Because people are still scratching their heads over some of the perhaps finer details, are they not, Lee? So you've written an article. What still puzzles you about the pensions revolution? Savers' top 10 queries revealed, as well as, thankfully, the answers as well. So what came out top?
Number one was, my provider doesn't offer the option I want, don't they have to? Which is quite an interesting question. And there's been a lot of comments in our stories about pensions freedoms about some firms actually making it quite difficult and putting a few hurdles in the way for people to actually do what they want with their pension, which is the whole idea of this, you know, new thing that came in earlier in the year. So PensionWise is the government's official pension service. So it's a very handy sort of 10 questions here. So if you're really confused about, you know, what pension freedoms is or all this sort of niggling questions, it's highly likely that you're not alone and that you are in these 10 questions that very kindly they've given to us and the answers. So it's very, very worth having a look at this. And there's all the sorts of stuff on here, sort of like, you know, is using a financial advisor a good idea, for example, which is, again, another one of those sort of bugbears that our readers are kind of on the fence on. It's like, oh, you know, don't pay for financial advice. You know, what's the point? And then some people are like, you know, it's great.
Well, I would have put that top in a way, because actually, with so many queries that we still have, you kind of think you need to go somewhere, don't you?
Yeah, but I mean, these are the questions that people are asking pensions-wise. So I'm not surprised that number one is the, you know, the my provider doesn't offer the option I want, don't they have to? Because we're getting a lot of complaints from people, as Lee said, who have been calling up their pension provider. Quite often, sometimes people who've got a number of different pension pots and some the old-fashioned life insurance company-style pensions, and they're discovering that they can't do what they want to do. Or they're saying you can do what you want to do, but you have to take financial advice, and financial advice is going to cost them a couple of grand. Or you can do what you want to do, but it's going to cost you X amount of money. But if you want to find out what these questions are and the answers to them, go to thisismoney.co.uk/pensions, and you'll find them there. And I must say that in at number six in the charts is, the paperwork I have received from my pension provider is confusing. Could you please explain my options? No surprises there. And jumping in at number seven is actually a classic question. What is the difference between a defined benefit and a defined contribution pension? And I think that there are an awful lot of people in this world who don't know the answer to that. And a defined benefit pension is an old-fashioned final salary style pension,
which
where
in the context of the freedoms, right?
Guarantees to pay you a certain amount for the rest of your life. A defined contribution pension is a new one where you have to pay in a certain amount, your employer pays a certain amount, it's invested, and you build up a pot at the end. And it is worrying, because pension freedoms mainly affect those with defined contribution pensions. And if you've got a defined benefit one, it's probably worth holding on to.
So if you do have any queries, do go to This Is Money, or you can call PensionWise for more information. I'm joined today, editor Simon Lambert, consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, Lee Boyce gets tough on the great landline rental rip-off. But first, how do you fancy having your own virtual assistant for your car so you never need miss a car tax renewal or perhaps an MOT again? And the cost, well, absolutely nothing. It's free. Yes, the AA has just launched a new personalised PA service called Automise, which notifies you when your car needs a little bit of care and attention. It works by storing all your tax, your MOT, insurance, servicing, repair service records online and you can access them any time that you like. So Lee, you're the car buff here. Tell us a bit more about this.
Yeah, this is quite a good little nifty little tool, this, I would suggest, especially with sort of tax changes and people getting confused as to when or if indeed they have tax on their car, especially if you've just bought a new car and everything. Sometimes it can get a bit confusing. And even now, you know, I went back to my mum's at the weekend. She was like, oh, I've just realised that my MOT's due in 2 days. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, you know, you should have really known that a couple of weeks ago, because it's going to be tough for you to just sort of slot in and get your MOT. So this service was built by the AA because it found that 9 in 10 people said elements of owning a car can be a hassle. So I think what I've tried to do is sort of do this little app where it just alerts you, you know, your car needs an MOT a couple of weeks' time. And I saw some of the comments. Someone said that they had this Automize app, and they actually sent a couple of quotes through from local garages that he didn't even know existed, and ended up being cheaper than he expected. Mm. Now, more cynical readers are saying that it's free. But what's happening with your personal details, basically? You know, are they going to start giving them to insurers and that sort of stuff? I'm not 100% sure on that, but you would have thought there must be some way that the AA is going to make some sort of money out of this. They can't be doing it out of the goodness of their hearts.
Presumably, they'd assume you'd go to AA over RAC or something.
Exactly, but I think it's a nifty little app, and we'll have to give it a try out and see how good it is. But it looks good on paper.
Simon?
Well, there is this saying on the internet that if you're not paying, you're the product. Mm-hmm. And basically, people don't like paying for stuff on the internet. Our website, for example, is free to use, and we make money from advertising. But the AA doesn't deserve all the credit for this, because actually, this is something that used to be called Motoriety, which was started up by a lady called Lucy Burnford. And I met up with her just after she started it up. And the AA, I think, has basically bought this and turned it into this automized thing. And her idea surrounded this thing of giving people this one place to put all their car details and helping them to find garages. And obviously, you make money off the back of that from like lead fees from garages and things like that. And the AA has obviously taken this on and taken it on a step. So well done to her, I say, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I remember when she showed it to me, I thought it was a really good idea.
When was this?
A couple of years back. But I did think, you know, it's very difficult with these kind of things to get the traction that you need to attract the number of people. That's the difficulty for any startup in that sort of situation, whatever field they're operating in, is how do you get all those customers? Because acquiring customers and advertising to customers is expensive. Yeah. The distribution network, it's a massive name, and they can advertise this to all of their customers. And I expect that many people will probably take this up.
You?
I'm not an AA customer. But I wouldn't have to be an AA customer, would I? No, I prefer to just randomly stick things in a drawer and try and remember when I meant to do them.
Fair enough. Why not? What about line rental prices? Lee, you've been looking at this one, and we're going to be talking about this now. And that is the price hikes of line rental. As firms ramp up prices year on year, is the watchdog ever going to do anything, you ask, about the landline rental ripoff? Now, following hot on the heels of telecoms giants BT and TalkTalk increasing rates in recent months, Sky have now joined the party, meaning prices have risen far faster than inflation in the last 5 years. But if you take a look at the prices, okay, BT £17.99 a month, Sky £17.40, TalkTalk £17.70, Virgin Media £16.99. They all look rather similar, don't they? A difference of just £1. It's raised concerns, critics suggesting that the providers are behaving like cartels. Well, earlier I spoke to Sally Francis, senior consumer writer from Money Saving Expert. Says Sky's move doesn't come as a big surprise to her.
BT announced price rises. They rose their line rental from £16.99 to £17.99. Plusnet did something similar back in September. TalkTalk's done the same. Mm. They're all reacting to each other, I think. So it's not really a surprise that Sky decided to increase its line rental price to keep up with the competition. But I would say, in addition to checking cheaper deals elsewhere, you could also try haggling with them and seeing where, even with the increased line rental, if you could cut costs elsewhere, you may still end up paying less. It's worth a try.
Well, we'll get on to haggling in a minute, but Lee, critics saying providers behaving like cartels.
Well, when I say critics, I mean that's a reader that's written in and actually prompted me to investigate this, because I find it hard to disagree. When you look back historically, in the last 5 years, you know, line rent has gone up from about £10 a month for most of them to about 18 quid now. It's got far faster than inflation.
What's the justification?
Well, this is exactly what's annoyed me about the whole, you know, I've gone to these companies and asked them, you know, tell me what this is going towards. And it's a classic, you know, well, it covers, you know, the cost of the physical line going to a customer's door. You know, it's going on to continued investment on our network. It just all sounds like a bit of hot air to me. I mean, what kind of improvements are going on? I don't really get the justification. And actually, my least favourite of the responses was from BT, who said the price rises are in common with the rest of the industry. That's exactly my point. You know, that's not a reason.
Everyone else is doing it,
so we're doing it. And I can't understand how they're getting away about the same time each year of just putting up their prices and line rental. And actually, the sneakiest thing about it is when you look at broadband deals, you know, it's always like, you know, £7 a month, £8 a month. Look how great our deal is. Yeah. And then you look at the small print at the bottom, you know, needs line rental of £18 a month. Well, thank you very much. And I just think Ofcom needs to have a look at this properly and actually investigate it. And to be honest with you, their response has just been toothless. They just swerved around any sort of answer given to me why line rental's going up. In fact, they didn't even mention line rental at all in their response. It was just kind of like, you know, our top priority is to ensure consumers get the best possible services at the lowest possible prices. And then started going on about, you know, how good value it is compared to people around Europe. And then I get an email from someone who's living in France who says his broadband's half the price that it is in the UK. So riddle me that. How's that happening?
I just want to come over there and give you a big cuddle.
Well, you know, it's frustrating, isn't it? Because at the end of the day, broadband's become a consumable sort of product that we all use. Okay, 10 years ago, perhaps not everyone had broadband. Not everyone has broadband now, but I mean, there's a lot more people that do. And I just don't understand how it can go up every year and then they're paying, you know, especially like BT, are paying fortune for their sports packages. What if you don't like sports? If this feels like costs are like creeping up elsewhere.
Are there any alternatives? Sorry, Simon, go.
Well, I was going to say that BT don't like it when you suggest that line rental's going up to pay for the cost of the football. But I know Lee's right. This is, you know, we flagged this a couple of weeks ago with the fact that line rental doubling the cost of the broadband deals. But this is a massive racket. Because you were going to say, is there anything you can do about it? Mm-hmm. And the question is basically people ask themselves, well, they go, well, I don't need this home phone. When do I ever use my home phone? I use my mobile all the time. This home phone is costing me a fortune. I'll get rid of it. Oh, hang on. If I get rid of it, I can't have my broadband. And broadband is now considered a necessity.
Yeah.
You know, so it is a racket. And one of the things that go into it is improving the network. Well, has anybody's home phone improved much over the last 5 years? You just pick the phone up and you call someone, don't you? It's fairly old technology. So then there's the argument that it's going towards improving the broadband network. But hang on a minute, I'm already paying for my broadband with the broadband element. There are some companies where you can get broadband without a phone. What's that one, Relish?
What are the alternatives?
Yeah. If you're in central London, though, I think it doesn't have a very broad, you know, I suppose alternatives are things like dongles and stuff. But if you're sort of really looking for a solid internet connection in your house, let's say that, you know, you run a business from home or something along those lines, ideally you're going to need a line going in through to your house. But talking about, you know, line rental and house phones, I mean, I'm with Virgin Media and they've installed a landline. I thought I might actually use that. It might come in handy. I can't use it. I get no dialing tone. It's just like a fuzzy noise because I think there's so many people living down my road now, whereas, you know, before it was probably just houses. It's like every house is converted into a three-story flat now. And I think there's just so many phone lines jammed into the system. So where's this promised improvements coming from? I don't know.
Go back to the old days of the operator connecting you, I say.
Do you reckon?
Yeah. Yes.
Well, let's give Lee a breather there. He's doing a U. Simon's going a little bit red. So I'm going to turn to you now, Simon. You've been taking a look at Britain's favourite topic, bricks and mortar. Buy to let, the property buzz phrase at the moment. But Simon, you've written a warning article that dirt cheap mortgages might be tempting investors down that route, but buyers beware, you say. So you've got a couple of minutes, Simon. Go for it. What have you been talking about?
People love buy-to-let, but there is this situation where the tax treatment is changing. So up until now, you've been able to offset your mortgage interest against your tax bill, your income tax bill on the rent. Now, George Osborne has decided that this is either unfair or an easy target for getting some money in, depending, delete as applicable. And he's stopped that, and you're only going to be able to get a maximum of 20% tax relief. So it's stepping down, and most landlords are probably 40% taxpayers. Now, there's a suggestion that this is going to affect those people who are sort of barely breaking even. But there's also something else going on that makes the playing field, you know, quite uneven between landlords and homeowners, because that tax treatment has long been a bugbear of critics of buy-to-let. And that's the fact that if you're going to invest in buy-to-let, most buy-to-let mortgages are interest-only. And so the cost is much, much lower. So there's and the deals are getting cheaper all the time, as many mortgages are. We ran some figures this week. There's a new deal out, 2-year fix, 1.84%. If you were a landlord, your mortgage payments would only, and you borrowed £150,000, would only be £230 a month. That's hardly anything. But if you were a homeowner, you'd have to borrow on a repayment mortgage, and your payments would be £630 a month, which is a big difference. So obviously the landlord is benefiting a lot there. The problem is, though, is at the end of that 2-year fixed rate period, the rate jumps to 5.79%, the standard variable rate, which all of a sudden your payments as a landlord would go from £230 a month to £724 a month. Now, I suspect that there aren't that many landlords out there raking in so much money on rent on sort of new buy-to-let purchases or buy-to-lets that have been bought in recent years that they could take a £500 hit every month, especially at a time when they're no longer going to be able to offset all of that money against their tax bill. And so most people work on the basis that they will be able to remortgage in those 2 years' time. But regulations are getting tighter around buy-to-let, and I would be very, very wary about thinking that I am going to be able to remortgage to a deal that is that cheap in 2 years' time as a landlord.
Thank you very much, Editor Simon Lambert there. Now on to our final story, shall we, in an article that starts a little bit like an Albert Camus novel. A month ago, I married a hoarder. Yes, take a look around your home, admit it. Are you a little bit of a hoarder? You never know when you may need 3 umbrellas, particularly the ones that are broken, but you just can't throw them out. Tesco receipts dating back to 2012, we've all got them. If this sounds like you, you may need some clutter-busting help. A new craze called ConMarie is apparently sweeping the nation, named after organising consultant Marie Kondo, whose book encourages us to change our lives through the power of cleaning, including telling us to purge sentimental tat and get rid of any joyless items. So we've already decided that you are a little bit of a hoarder, the pair of you. But tell us a little bit more, if you would, about Marie Kondo's book, Lee. What's she advocating here?
Well, I read this story and actually I thought I wasn't going to really sort of glean anything like interesting out of it. I didn't really think it was my sort of cup of tea, you know what I mean? But I read it and I actually found it really quite interesting. And basically it's all about sort of going around your house or your flat, going one room at a time, to sort of looking at, you know, stuff that you've hoarded or old clothes. Let's say clothes, and you're looking at your clothes, and she's asking, you have to ask yourself, does this bring me joy? Which, you know, it sounds daft.
Just imagine you going around your home.
Yeah, I'm just looking at this T-shirt. Does this bring me joy? Does it bring other people joy when I wear it? Possibly not. So it's going to go in the bin. And I was thinking, actually, no, it's good. I'd love to get my girlfriend to do this. She has, her wardrobe is just like an absolute bomb site. If she just picked up some of those clothes and put them in the bin, I'd be a happy man. But yeah, it's all about sort of just getting rid of your tat, really. And actually, what I really liked about it is that you're not allowed to do it with any music on in the background, because it's distracting. You've got to do it in silence, which sounds like Orwellian.
She does give a top 10 tips for decluttering your home. In terms of your girlfriend, Lee, I rather like the idea that if you haven't worn it in the last year, you will not wear it. Get out. I mean, obviously seasonal issues.
Yeah, indeed.
And I completely changed my wardrobe from then on, and now a little bit short on clothes. So I need to top them up regularly. Simon, your views?
What I like about it is also the tips for storing things. So in this story, basically, the journalist who wrote it followed, you know, this. And what you have to do is you have to fold your underwear a certain way. So Zoe Phillimore, who wrote this, did that. And amongst those top 10 tips is stack items in drawers vertically. This way you'll see everything easily rather than having to sift through piles. And when I first read that, I thought, well, hang on a minute. If you stack something, it has to be vertical. You can't stack stuff that isn't vertical. That's the definition of stacking. And then I realised it's like put your T-shirts up the other way. So normally you'd put them flat and pile them up like that, whereas you put them sort of on their side, and it's a bit like flicking through records or something. And I quite like that. And also fold, don't ball your socks.
Yeah,
folding socks makes them last longer. And one for the ladies, empty your handbag once a day and take out unnecessary items.
I'm looking at mine falling out of stuff in the corner of the room here. My favourite, don't tell all your loved ones about your decluttering plans. It might make them worry.
That will happen if I go home tonight.
They might even try and put you off.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tip number 9. Keeping things just in case is a false economy. In the meantime, they're causing clutter and stress. Just let them go.
So true.
Just let them go. I'm going to let you go. Editor Simon Lambert, Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce, thank you so much for joining us. Share Radio.